Well, good evening. It's great to look out and see those who've come out to study God's Word tonight. We're happy to be together as always and thankful, especially if you're visiting with us as we're studying about heaven. We're in chapter 12 of the book, Heaven, Oh for a Home with God. That's page 110 if you have your book and you're following along with us. The title of the lesson is We Are Being Prepared for Something Great. And we just need to have that spirit of anticipation within us that in fact heaven is going to be great. Something that beyond perhaps even what we can imagine, but there are things that the scriptures tell us about the experience, and we need to understand that heaven is something that truly we can long for, that truly we can anticipate with just every fiber of our being, and we won't be disappointed at all. The chapter in your book begins with a story about a man who'd been unfaithful for a while, and Christians went to visit him and try to encourage him and talk to him about his soul. And, you know, as is commonly the case in situations like that, you say something like, well, don't let anything keep you from heaven. You know, people talk about, well, I haven't been faithful, or I've fallen away, or I'm not going to church because of this. And so you say, well, don't let anything keep you from heaven. And the man's response was, well, what are we going to do up there anyway? Float around on clouds and sing all the time? That such a sad attitude that this particular individual had. It shows a colossal lack of understanding of what heaven is about, number one, and also a colossal lack of spirituality on the man's part. You know, there are just a lot of people in the world, unfortunately some Christians who call themselves Christians at least, you know, who have about all of the spirituality of a summer sausage, I guess, which isn't much. In the book of Psalms, the psalmist says in Psalm 10 and verse 4, the wicked in his pride says he does not seek God, and God is in none of his thoughts. And you know, a lot of people live their lives that way. But we want to say about heaven tonight that it's not boring. It is something that can be looked forward to. The particular man in the story is somebody who, as I said, doesn't understand what heaven is about and why we should look forward to it. It's not just floating around on a cloud and singing all the time. Maybe it is a lot of singing. Maybe it is a lot of praise, but there's a lot more to it than that. Of course, if you love singing, that would be enough. If you appreciate praising God, that in itself would be enough. But there's way more to it than that, as we'll explore in this lesson. It really is. It's really sad, and you hope the particular individual in the story learned otherwise before it was too late. There's a big contrast between that and what we read in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 9, which says, eye has not seen nor ear heard, nor have entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him. And Jeff and I, in writing the book, we recognize that that passage is really talking about the entire plan of salvation, that what God prepared in sending Christ to bring us into a relationship with him, to have a hope of eternity. Really, that whole plan is what's being thought about in 1 Corinthians 2. But the bottom line of it is, what he's prepared for us is a way to get to heaven, and heaven itself. And it's just beyond our imaginations. It's just beyond anything, any expectation we could have. It surpasses that, the things that he has prepared for those who love him. It's tailor-made by God to be breathtaking splendor, as we talk about in the book. You know, in John chapter 14 and verse 3, Jesus said, I go to prepare a place for you. He had said, in my Father's house are many mansions, and a better translation is probably dwelling places, but still dwelling places in the house of the Father. You know, how could that possibly be beat? What could possibly be better than that? In Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 16, and talking about the people of faith who are not living for this world but looking for a city, the writer says that about God, that he has prepared a city for them. So all of these passages are saying to us, God has made something for us, prepared something specifically for us that is going to be tremendous. You remember we talked in previous lesson about the painting of heaven, if you will, that we have in Revelation 21 and 22. And and the number 12 there and how that symbolizes the people of God and how everything in heaven is designed with 12 in mind, with the people of God in mind. And it's going to be just the perfect place for us in every way. When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. So after 10,000 years, what are we going to do? We say, whew, I'm glad that 10,000 year singing was over. I'm getting tired of that. What are we going to do next? I don't think that's going to be the attitude. Sing for another 10,000 years. That sounds good to me, you know. So that needs to be our attitude about that. But as we said, and we'll see in this lesson, there's more than singing to it. There's more than praising God. That would be enough. But I think there's going to be a good bit more than all of that. Heaven has always been, from all eternity, as far as we know anything about it, as far as the Bible reveals, a place of activity, a place where a lot of exciting things are going on. And it's never depicted in the scriptures as some place where, you know, it's ho-hum and people are just not excited. In fact, every time that we're given a glimpse into heaven, whether you look at Ezekiel or Isaiah or Revelation or some of the other little glimpses we're given into heaven, every time it's like, wow, something astounding and stunning and awesome is going on in heaven. Whether it's with God or the angels or other beings that are there, it's always sort of enthralling and full of splendor. And we see that in so many places. And when we're given a glimpse into the dwellers of heaven, who we know are God the Father and the Son, but also an innumerable company of angels is described in the book of Revelation as being there among other creatures and beings. We have a lot of activity going on. So in Matthew chapter 6, Jesus teaches us to pray, "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." God's will is done in heaven by the angels and other beings that are there, of course. That would include the cherubim that are described, the four living creatures, and others that we might think about. So the angels in heaven, they are very attuned to what God is trying to accomplish. In Luke chapter 15, you have the stories of the lost coin and the lost sheep. And when Jesus gets to talking about the lost being found, he says, there's joy in heaven, greater joy in heaven, over one sinner that repents than over 99 that need no repentance. He says that there's joy in the presence, Luke 15 and verse 10, joy in the presence of the angels of heaven. So just think about that. What does that say to us about what's going on among the angels in heaven, maybe even right now? Do they have an awareness of things that are going on here on earth? Are they happy about good things that are going on here on earth? It's like, you know, what are they doing in heaven? Well, they don't have television. No, they're watching earth. You know, they're watching the souls of men and their relationship with God. So, such a wonderful picture of activity in heaven, joy in heaven, awareness in heaven of man's struggle on earth and the good things that God is doing for us and through us. So these angels who are before the throne of God, they have watched the salvation story, the plan of redemption unfold throughout human history. They saw Jesus come, put on flesh, fight his battles with Satan. They saw him bruise Satan's head. They saw him gain the victory at the resurrection and the ascension. Surely there was such fascination among the angels in that story. In 1 Peter chapter 1, then, you have this description about all that the prophets said in the Old Testament about the coming of the Christ and God's plan of redemption. "Of this salvation, the prophets have inquired and searched carefully who prophesied of the grace that would come to you, searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ who is in them was indicating when he testified beforehand the sufferings of Christ and the glories that would be revealed. To them it was revealed that not to themselves, but to us they were ministering the things which now have been reported to you through those who have preached the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven. Things which, the last phrase is what I want you to focus on, things which angels desire to look into. So the inhabitants of heaven, what are we seeing? Have a huge interest in the salvation story as it's unfolding. They desire to look into these things and see them unfold and are watching even now as they unfold. And who knows what excitement there will be in heaven at the culmination of God's plan of redemption of mankind. And, you know, what a great experience that would be. And the great thing is, folks, if we are in heaven, we're going to get to see the reaction of the angels to our own salvation, and we're going to get to rejoice with them in that. So I don't know about you, but rejoicing with an innumerable company of angels, that's going toward the top of my bucket list, right? It's a bucket list of things to do after you die. We need to all start one of those. Here's things I want to do after I die. But that's going to the top of that list. What we're going to say in this next section is, I'm sorry, I'm behind on my advancing the slides as normal. But what we want to talk about in this next section is that surely heaven is a place of splendor and wonder, and it's not just something that we're being prepared to go to, but it's a place that's being prepared for us. And so there's an interchange there between our growth and development in this life and also what is going to be going on in heaven with us when we get there. And that sort of exciting interplay between the two is something we're going to look at in this lesson. The little phrase that Jeff came up with, which I think is really appropriate for this aspect of our study, he says that God's servants are always proven before they're promoted. And so leading this life and going to the heavenly realm is like a huge promotion, if you want to think of it that way. We're going on to greater things, and this life is the proving ground for that. If we think all of our activity in relation to God is in this life, we missed it. You know, this life is the proving ground for greater things to come. And it's those things that eventually we'll get to in this lesson. But much of the first half of this lesson, which we'll cover tonight then, deals with using Joseph, his example from the Old Testament, as sort of a demonstration of what God is doing with us and for us and how he is preparing us for something great. That just as he, in Joseph's life, was all along preparing Joseph for something great, unbeknownst, if I can use that word, unbeknownst to Joseph, God was preparing him for great, great things, which Joseph could not have imagined, by the way, I think, early on. But he was being prepared for that. And that preparation had to do with him going through a number of experiences which tried him and proved him, gave him the ability. So let's take this sort of interesting, I think, look at Joseph. Joseph had his dreams, didn't he? I mean, not just figuratively. We have dreams about heaven, but Joseph really had dreams about what God had prepared for him. So you go back to Genesis 37, which is what we want to do. We're going to look at the story of Joseph in some detail, so you might want to go back to Genesis and we'll read several passages. But you remember the dreams that that Joseph had. He sees these sheaves in the field and they're bowing down to him. And then he sees the stars and the sun and the moon and they're bowing down to him. And he tells the first dream to his brothers. And he tells the second dream, apparently, to the whole family. And the reaction of the family to Joseph's dreams is what? Yeah, kind of disgust. Who do you think you are? You think we're going to bow down to you? That sort of thing. And so you see in Genesis chapter 37, verses 10 and 11, He told it to his father about the second dream and his brothers. His father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come and bow down to the earth before you?" His brothers envied him, but his father kept this matter in his mind. You realize that Jacob knew there was something to this. People in those days, especially if it's recorded in Scripture about some dream that they had, it wasn't like some crazy dream that we may have had about, you know, some mundane thing. They realized, as was sometimes the case, that God was communicating things to them in these dreams. And that is prevalent, of course, in the life of Joseph. It happens to be a big part of Joseph's story. What else are you going to conclude if you're having these dreams? If Jacob kept them in his heart, surely in his mind, surely Joseph would have as well. And what's Joseph's thought? What does he think is going to happen in the future? Well, he doesn't know, but he's elevated to some really great position where his whole family is honoring him and bowing down before him as if he's some sort of great individual. I think that's a little bit like the pictures that we're given of heaven. We read Revelation and we kind of get, wow, there's going to be some great things here. It's going to be beautiful. But we don't really know exactly what all of that means. And I don't think Joseph knew exactly what this meant, but he knew that God had destined him for great things. And as Jeff says in this part of the book, he knew it meant something, and he knew it meant something great. We know the same thing about our dreams of heaven. The visions that God has given us in the book of Revelation, in Isaiah, in Ezekiel. It means something, and it means something great for our futures. Just because I don't know exactly what it means doesn't mean that I don't know that it's great. So he had those dreams, and then he had training. If God is going to elevate him to this position, God's going to train him. He's going to prove him before he promotes him. I don't know about you. Maybe when you were young, how old was Joseph when all this started? 17, right? 16, 17. So he was very young. Maybe when you were that age, I can remember when I was that age, I had ideas about my future, hopes for the future. You know, I was going to be a CFO of some corporation. You know, when I was 17, I was going into business and be a CFO of some corporation. I was sure that was going to happen. I could just picture myself there. Of course, I had no idea of what it would actually take in real life to get from where I was to any such thing. But, you know, you had this dream. And then a few years later, you know, as things switched around in my life, I thought about, wow, you know, I'm going to be a preacher of the gospel. What an exciting thing. And I'm going to get to go to foreign lands maybe and preach the gospel and work with a great church like Eastside or something like that. Can you imagine a 22-year-old, you know, having all these great visions of what he's going to do? I had no idea what it was going to take in my life to get me from where I was then to a position where I could even halfway handle the things I was dreaming about. But God takes you through a lot of things to get you where he wants you to be in life, and what we're saying about is in heaven itself. So that's what he's doing. That's what he's going to do with Joseph. Let's just see what Joseph went through. The first thing is he sold into slavery, and he's taken down to Potiphar's house. And he learns how to run a man's house. If you look in Genesis chapter 39, he learns how to do that, and he learns that God is with him in doing whatever position God puts him in. Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man. Now, those two things go together. The Lord was with Joseph. He was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. His master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Excuse me. Then he made him overseer of his house and All that he put under his authority. So it was from that time, from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. And Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. So Joseph is put in this situation. He obviously is determining to do the best he can in the situation, and God is blessing his efforts. And no doubt he's learning all kinds of stuff, growing in all sorts of ways as he handles this work of overseeing this house. So he learned that. He learned the organizational skills and the leadership skills to run a man's house. He deals with the issue with Potiphar's wife, which we'll talk about some more in just a little bit. But he's thrown into prison as a result of that. If we go on in chapter 39 and look in verses 20 and following, Joseph's master took him, put him in the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the prison. But the Lord again was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison, whatever they had, whatever they did there, it was his doing. Think about that kind of responsibility. It's a whole different thing than looking over Potiphar's house and managing that. Now he's managing prisoners, different kind of people, different situation, but he's, again, blessed by God and learning a lot through that and growing and developing in all of that. And then where does God put him at the end? What's he over at the end? All of Egypt, right? He's elevated to Pharaoh's right hand, and he's in charge of everything in Egypt except Pharaoh himself, basically. So he's essentially the de facto king of Egypt. And you can read that in Genesis chapter 41, verses 39 and following. So first he's a servant, then he's a ruler, and that's the way Joseph's life went. But that wasn't near the end of what God had in store for him. You might think that being elevated to Pharaoh's household was the ultimate end that God had. You'd say, well, that would be awesome enough, just getting to that position. You know what? You and I are being prepared to sit at the right hand of the king. In fact, Jesus says to sit on my throne with me, to reign with me. We think that would be awesome, truly. That would be so wonderful. But that's not it. That's not all that God has planned, as if that wouldn't be enough. Joseph's being prepared to sit at Pharaoh's right hand, sure enough. But what else is actually going to happen with his family? He's going to wind up saving his family. He's going to wind up, just as he dreamed, them honoring him for basically being the one God used to redeem them, to save them. And I, to put it in a sort of casual way, but I know that he felt good down to his toes when that experience came to be. You just can't imagine the joy, and we'll talk about that maybe some more in a minute. But he had this proven character. In 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 16, Paul tells Timothy to take heed to himself, to the doctrine, to continue in them. In doing this, you'll save yourself and those who hear you. Timothy's basically being said, your salvation is dependent upon your true character. You pay attention to what you're teaching. You live life. You practice what you preach. And that's going to wind up to your salvation and the salvation of others. That's kind of what Joseph was going through. Doing what he was supposed to be doing, heeding God, And ultimately, that winds up in his salvation and the salvation of others. In Philippians chapter 2 and verse 22, a passage not in your book on this point, but Paul there is commending Timothy. And he says about him to the Philippians, he says, you know his proven character. Y'all remember that passage, Philippians 2, 22? You know his proven character. Timothy was continually being given more and more response. If you follow, Timothy's an interesting study. We could have used him almost like we're using Joseph. Interesting study of being taken as a young man, being given more and more responsibility, being trusted with big projects and big things by Paul all along the way. And you come to Philippians 2, you come to 2 Timothy, and you realize that all of that trust that was given to Timothy was so well given, and that he did truly prove his character. That's what we see back with Joseph. He was tempted in the house of Potiphar. We call that the second pit. The first pit was the one he was thrown into, right? Sold into slavery out of that one. The second pit, Jeff brings up Proverbs 23 and verse 27, a harlot is a deep pit. I don't know that Potiphar's wife was a harlot, but she wasn't far from a harlot because she was attempting to do the same kinds of things. That was a pit as well, but Joseph made his way out of that. God uses things like that, temptations and trials and tests and troubles and tragedies, not to get us to do wrong, but to strengthen us, to mold us, to be more like him. One thing leads to another in our growth process, and we're never promoted by God until we're first proven. So, he was proven, Joseph was, and then he was promoted. Let's share some of these verses together. Let's look at Psalm 105 and verse 17. This psalm is kind of telling the history of the Israelites and praising God throughout it. But Psalm 105, 17 says, moreover, he called for a famine in the land. He destroyed all the provisions of bread. He sent a man before them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. They hurt his feet with fetters. He was laid in irons until the time that the word came to pass. The word of the Lord tested him. If you really look at what's being said there, God sent Joseph. We know that from the story in Genesis itself, but here the psalm is saying it as well. God sent Joseph down to Egypt. You think that's how Joseph felt when he was sold into slavery? Oh, God's sending me down here. He didn't know that. But he was trusting God all the way. He was sold as a slave. He was bound in fetters and irons, as the text says. God had a plan for all of it. But the word of the Lord tested him. Somebody explain that. The word of the Lord tested him. Yeah, exactly. He put him in situations where he could prove his character. Again, not to get him to sin, but to get him to prove his character. That's how God used the trials. Yeah. Sure. So exactly. So Joseph goes through the peaks and the valleys, and it doesn't matter if it's a low or a high. He continues to trust God, continues to build his character throughout that, and winds up doing exactly, of course, what God intended all along. James chapter 1 and verse 12, and this applies the same principle then to us. Blessed is the man who endures temptations, for when he has been proved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. So that's what we're going through. We're enduring the trials, we're enduring the temptations, so that we can come to fulfill our dream of heaven, that crown of life that the Lord has promised. Romans chapter 5, verses 3 and 4, puts it this way, not only this, but we also exult in tribulations. Now, I don't know if you like that translation or not. What's exult mean? E-X-U-L-T. That's a big whoopee, right? Yeah. We exalt. We're, woo, tribulations. Is that how we feel about tribulations? Well, not usually. You know, tribulations are usually things we complain about, you know. But really, when you think about them, what Paul's saying is, well, you can exalt in tribulations. You can exalt, you know, you can hoop and holler, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance. Perseverance, proven character. Proven character. Character that's passed the test. And proven character produces, what's the last word? Hope. Hope. Hope is a desire and an expectation of something great in the future, something that a promise to be received in this case, which is heaven itself. So our experience and Joseph's experience are much parallel. You can just take these New Testament passages, lay them aside, those Old Testament passages about Joseph, and you can see, in essence, our journey to heaven, we're going through the same basic things that Joseph was. So I think it's a great parallel. At Joseph's first pit, the one his brothers threw him in, he learned not to be bitter. Ultimately, Joseph is going to forgive his brothers. In a very moving scene, when he finally reveals himself to them when they come down to Egypt for food later on. And Joseph's second, in his first pit, he learns to overcome bitterness. In his second pit, he learns moral character and resisting strong fleshly temptation. He said, as Freddie already mentioned, he couldn't commit this great wickedness and sin against God. In the third pit, which was really him being thrown into prison, I think one of the things he overcame there was a hit to his reputation. This is something that takes a lot of people down, that derails a lot of people. When folks are saying bad things about you and you don't really deserve it, when your reputation is taking a hit even though you've been doing what you're supposed to be doing. And a lot of people that don't make it through that one. But even there, Joseph trusted in God. He knew who he was, even if others might have accused him of something else. Joseph, I think the only, to me, and I may be wrong about this, somebody correct me if you can think of something, the only real indication that Joseph had about an outcome being good were those dreams. I don't think God ever gave him any more information about where we're going with this than those dreams. Doug? Yeah. Looking back, 2020. Yeah.
And that's sometimes what it takes for us to do the difficult times. We're wondering, what am I going to do? And after we go through it and we're tested and pass the test, we can say, I'm a better person now. I know better.
So, you know, I'm sure most of you heard, but if you didn't, what Doug's saying is, it's after you go through the test and you look back and you see how God has brought you through, and that you are stronger, that you are better as a result of the test and the trial and all of that. Joseph, that's, looking back, he could see what God had done, and he knew that God's hand was in all of that, which does him credit, because a lot of times we don't give God what we ought to as far as that goes. Right. That's a great phrase. God makes no earthly sense. That's not human wisdom. We would never come up with something like this. That's not how we do it. But God always does things in a way that are astounding to us, but perfect to him.
Against Pharaoh's dream was the first indication that Joseph had that God
When he was elevated out of the prison and got to interpret Pharaoh's dream, I think no doubt he saw God's mighty hand was about to do something really tremendous, which he did. The whole thing, as we say in the book, only made sense to him looking at it in reverse. When the reel was going forward, I don't think he ever saw it. Mike says it's far different than the dreams that he had, but far better. And that's what I'm telling you about heaven. I mean, the dreams that Joseph had were inspiring, no doubt, but the reality of what he was able to do with God's hand upon him, way beyond what he could have imagined with those dreams. There's a song in our book, I don't think we sing it much here, I've sung it a few times, it's called Until Then. The lines go like this: "And things of earth that cause my heart to tremble, remembered there will only bring a smile. But until then, my heart will go on singing. Until then, with joy, I'll carry on. Until the day my eyes behold the city. Until the day God calls me home." I tell you what, in heaven, looking back, as Joseph looked back over his life, everything becomes clear what God will have done with us and for us. And until then, we just trust him that's how it's going to be. Joseph had never read Genesis. Lauren. If you miss heaven, you just missed everything. Yeah. And sometimes from this side of it, we're like that man at the beginning of the lesson, you know. What's going to go on in heaven? Why is that so great? But I hope we're getting a feel for, in fact, it is great and greater than even what we can anticipate. The point I was making from the book is that Joseph didn't know. He hadn't read Genesis. You know, he was living it. He hadn't read his story yet. It was going to be written actually sometime later. But in Romans chapter 15 and verse 4, whatever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the scriptures might have hope. Boy, if there's any story in the Old Testament that fits that for us, it's Joseph. Through patience and comfort of the scriptures that we get from the scriptures, we have hope as well. So, you know, just reviewing what we've said, Joseph had his dreams. He had training that God provided as a servant. He had his character tested and proven. And then he was promoted, saves his family, the joy of seeing his family again, his father coming down, all of the blessings that came to him in his latter life, and the trust in God. One of the amazing things about Joseph's story, of course, is when he does reveal himself to his brothers. It's such a moving scene, and I want to kind of end the class today. We're going to go on and finish this lesson, Lord willing, on Sunday morning. But I want to end the class tonight by looking at Genesis 45. His brothers appear before him. They don't know who he is. Here he is, second in command of all of Egypt, distributing food to starving people from all over. Joseph says to his brothers in Genesis 45 and verse 3, "I am Joseph. Does my father still live?" His brothers could not answer him. They were dismayed in his presence. Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come near to me." So they came near, and he said to them, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years, the famine has been in the land." And he says, "There are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing or harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives for a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord over all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt." The the wisdom and understanding of Joseph about what had actually happened. That's what I want us to see. He's a perfect example of that. Yeah. Super. All right, we're going to pick up there Sunday morning. Thanks for your attention tonight. Hope that's helpful to you. And I think we'll study some things in the last half of this lesson that'll be really good about understanding what to anticipate in heaven.